Consequently, there was no one who realized the gravity of her failure to develop any intellectual imagination, to hold her empire together, any general education in common ideas that would make men fight and work for the empire as men will fight and work for a dear possession. But the rulers of the Roman Empire didn't want their citizens to fight for anything in any spirit at all. The rich had eaten the heart out of their general population, and they were content with the meal they had made. Legions were filled with Germans, Britons, Numidians, and the like. And until the very end, the wealthy Romans thought they could go on buying barbarians to defend them against the enemy without and the rebel poor within. How little was done in education by the Romans is shown by an account of what was done, says Mr. H. Stuart Jones. Julius Caesar bestowed Roman citizenship on teachers of the liberal arts. Vespasian endowed professorships of Greek and Latin oratory at Rome, and later emperors, especially Antoninus Pius, extended the same benefits to the provinces. Local enterprise and munificence were also devoted to the cause of education. We learn from the correspondence of the younger Pliny that public schools were founded in the towns of northern Italy. But though there was a wide diffusion of knowledge under the empire, there was no true intellectual progress. Augustus, it's true, gathered about him the most brilliant writers of his time, and the debut of the new monarchy coincided with the golden age of Roman literature. But this was of brief duration, and the beginnings of the Christian era saw the triumph of classicism and the first steps in the decline which awaits all literary movements which look to the past rather than the future. There's a diagnosis of the intellectual decadence of the age in a treatise upon the sublime by a Greek writer who wrote somewhere in the 2nd, 3rd, or 4th century A.D., and who may possibly have been Longinus Philologus, which states very distinctly one manifest factor in the mental sickness of the Roman world. He's cited by Gibbon, the sublime Longinus, who in somewhat a later period and in the court of a Syrian queen, Zenobia, preserved the spirit of ancient Athens, observes and laments the degeneracy of his contemporaries, which debased their sentiments, enervated their courage, and depressed their talents. In the same manner, says he, as some children always remain pygmies, whose infant limbs have been too closely confined, thus our tender minds, fettered by the prejudices and habits of a just servitude, are unable to expand themselves or to attain that well-proportioned greatness which we admire in the ancients, who, living under a popular government, wrote with all the same freedom as they acted. But this critic grasped only one aspect of the restraints upon mental activity. The leading strings that kept the Roman mind in a permanent state of infantilism constituted a double servitude. They were economic as well as political. The account Gibbon gives of the life and activities of a certain Herodes Atticus, who lived in the time of Hadrian, shows just how little was the share of the ordinary citizen in the outward magnificence of the time. This Atticus had an immense fortune, and he amused himself by huge architectural benefactions to various cities. Athens was given a race course, and a theatre of cedar, curiously carved, was set up there to the memory of his wife. A theatre was built at Corinth, a race course was given to Delphi, baths to Thermopylae, an aqueduct to Canusium, and so on and so on. One struck by the spectacle of a world of slaves and common people who weren't consulted, and over whose heads, without any participation on their part, this rich man indulged in his displays of taste. Numerous inscriptions in Greece and Asia still preserve the name of Herodes Atticus, patron and benefactor, who ranged about the empire as though it was his private garden, commemorating himself by these embellishments. He didn't confine himself to splendid buildings. He was also a philosopher, though none of his wisdom has survived. He had a large villa near Athens, and there philosophers were welcome guests, so long as they convinced their patron of the soundness of their pretensions, received his discourses with respect, and didn't offend him by insolent controversy. The world, it's evident, was not progressing during these two centuries of Roman prosperity. But was it happy in its stagnation? There are signs of a very unmistakable sort that the great mass of human beings in the empire, a mass numbering something between 100 and 150 millions, was not happy, was probably very acutely miserable beneath its outward magnificence. True, there were no great wars and conquests within the empire, little of famine or fire or sword to afflict mankind. But on the other hand, there was a terrible restraint by government, and still more by the property of the rich, upon the free activities of nearly everyone. Life, for the great majority, who were neither rich nor official, nor the womankind, and the parasites of the rich and official, must have been laborious, tedious, and lacking in interest and freedom to a degree that a modern mind can scarcely imagine. Three things in particular may be cited to sustain the opinion that this period was a period of widespread unhappiness. The first of these is the extraordinary apathy of the population to political events. They saw one upstart pretender to empire succeed another with complete indifference. Such things didn't seem to matter to them. Hope had gone. When presently the barbarians poured into the empire, there was nothing but the legions to face them. There was no popular uprising against them at all. Everywhere the barbarians must have been outnumbered if only the people had resisted. But the people didn't resist. It's manifest that, to the bulk of its inhabitants, the Roman Empire didn't seem to be a thing worth fighting for. To the slaves and common people, the barbarian probably seemed to promise more freedom and less indignity than the pompous rule of the imperial official and grinding employment by the rich. The looting and burning of palaces and an occasional massacre didn't shock the folk of the Roman underworld as it shocked the wealthy and cultured people to whom we owe such accounts as we have of the breaking down of the imperial system. Great numbers of slaves and common people probably joined the barbarians, who knew little of racial or patriotic prejudices and were open-handed to any promising recruit. No doubt in many cases the population found that the barbarian was a worse infliction even than the tax-gatherer and the slave-driver. But that discovery came too late for resistance or the restoration of the old order. And as a second symptom that points to the same conclusion that life was hardly worth living for the poor and the slaves and the majority of people during the age of the Antonines, we must reckon the steady depopulation of the empire. People refused to have children. They did so, we suggest, because their homes weren't safe from oppression, because, in the case of slaves, there was no security that the husband and wife wouldn't be separated, because there was no pride nor reasonable hope in children any more. In modern states, the great breeding ground has always been the agricultural countryside, where there's a more or less secure peasantry. But under the Roman Empire, the peasant and the small cultivator was either a worried debtor, or he was held in a network of restraints that made him a spiritless serf, or he'd been ousted altogether by the gang production of slaves. The third indication that this outwardly flourishing period was one of deep unhappiness and mental distress for vast multitudes is to be found in the spread of new religious movements throughout the population. We've seen how, in the case of the little country of Judea, a whole nation may be infected by the persuasion that life is unsatisfactory and wrong, and that something is needed to set it right. The mind of the Jews, as we know, had crystallized about the idea of the promise of the one true God and the coming of a Savior or Messiah.